Hello, and welcome to A Sense of Centerville and Washington Township, your place for stories about ordinary and extraordinary residents and places in the Centerville and Washington Township area. I'm your host, Susan Melville, from Centerville, Washington History, and I look forward to hearing your story. Today, my guest is Robert Tobobin. Robert Tobobin, Ph.D., is Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Wright State University in Dayton, Ohio, where he taught for over 40 years. He was born in 1924 in Cleveland, Ohio. He married Janet Smith in 1947, and they became parents of two sons. Robert got a bachelor's degree from Ohio University, a master's degree from Miami University, and a Ph.D. from University of Cincinnati. He moved to Centerville around 1960 and was the first political science teacher at Wright State University.
That's right.
He is the author, co-author, or editor of six books and over 50 essays and articles. During World War II, he was a soldier in the 111th Infantry in the Pacific Theater and participated in three campaigns, the Gilbert Islands, the Marshall Islands, and the Palau Islands. He was a visiting fellow at Cambridge University in the 80s and traveled extensively for work and pleasure. He stays active by writing and staying physically active through walking. Thank you for being here and being willing to talk to us about some of your experiences. So as we talked on the phone, you shared experiences as a soldier at the age of 19.
Right.
Could you share a bit about what life was like during the 40s leading up to the war?
Yes, I can. Okay. The reason I was going to Ohio U, this was in 1942. Incidentally, you might be interested in this. My tuition the first year at Ohio U was $45 a semester. And I worked in the kitchen at sorority houses to get my free food. But that's pretty amazing because I just put two kids through college and grandchildren through college and things like that. I joined the Army I thought it was a very good reason. I was going to go to Cleveland with some friends of mine. They were going to join the Navy. I thought, I'll join the Navy. But I had a date with this she was pretty hot blonde from Ironton, Ohio. I don't remember her name, but I said, I have a date this week. I'll join the Army. So you can see I didn't give any thought at all. I didn't care where I went. I wanted to go. In those days, everybody did really want to go. I was 18. No, I enlisted when I was... Yeah, I enlisted on December 12th of 42. I signed up for the draft, and I had a draft card. I felt I was a man now. And I went to Ohio U in September of 42, and that was my first year of university work, and I took a standard academic course, and I joined the ROTC, and so when that year ended, I went directly into the Army on June the 1st of 1943. Yeah, I just turned I turned 19, and I went to Camp Wheeler in Georgia. It doesn't exist anymore. It was a temporary thing. And I was there for 3 months, and then they teach you to be a soldier. That's where you got infantry training. That's what I was going to be in. And I went through the Army, I realized, boy, this could be very dangerous. And I remember sitting under a tree saying, you know, this is dangerous. And so I signed up for ASTP. That's the Advanced Officers Training Corps. I thought, well, maybe I can go back to college. Well, I passed the test. There was about half a dozen guys. And when my battalion left there and they were heading for California, I knew they were going to the Pacific, and so did they. I said, well, goodbye. I'll see you. And we were left behind because we were going back to college. About 2 days later, they decided they didn't need any more engineers or language specialists. And so they just said, no, you're back in the Army, and you're not going to go to college. So I went out to California, and that's where I joined the 111th Infantry. They had been part of the 28th Division, But in 1940, they divided the, they sent, they, there was four regiments in a division. My regiment was kicked out, and the 28th Division went to Europe, and they were in the Battle of Bulge and all that. And we went to the Pacific, and I went there, and I was only because I had a year of college, they thought, well, you must be some kind of a genius. And actually, I didn't know anything. But they made me, they said, we're going to make you into an aide man. I said, I don't know anything about it. He said, we'll teach you on the boat going over. And they didn't do anything. We went over to Hawaii, and I could have joined any battalion. There's three battalions in a regiment in those days. And they said, you can walk into any line you want. So I walked into the 3rd Battalion because it was closest. And I, in 2 weeks later, we're heading out for the first campaign. And the other two battalions stayed in Hawaii for a year while we were out. And we were going on, and what was a big campaign, it was really the first campaign in the Central Pacific. You have to understand the Pacific War, there's two campaigns. There's a Central Pacific and there's a Southwest. MacArthur had the Southwest. I was headed by Nimitz. And Admiral Nimitz. And we went out to, you may have heard of this battle, Tarawa. It was a big battle. That was taken by the Marines. I went to the next island up, which was Macon Island. That was an Army operation. And Tarawa was a terrible battle. Ours was not. We had about 1,200, 1,500 Japanese soldiers there, and they were taken out in 3 days. And then the assault troops, let me make this clear. When you go out on a campaign, there's assault troops. That's the ones that would go in on the first wave, okay? Okay, these guys get beat up so bad that they have with death and with wounds, that they pull them out as soon as the fighting actually ends. The fighting ended in 2.5 days. And then we went in. Then my regiment goes in, and we're called mop-up. We're basically a support regiment. But we were only one battalion. The 3rd Battalion went in. And we went in there, and every day we would get bombed, and occasionally strafed. Bombing became so, you can tell where the bombs are coming. Oh, that might be a story. You want me to tell that? The first night the sergeant said, dig in. And my friend and I, his name was John Serville, we dug about 4-inch hole, and we said, well, it'll be okay. Well, then the air raid sirens went off, and the Japanese planes came over, and we could hear the bombs dropping. It was really kind of beautiful. The way, you know, palm trees were waving, and the lights were going in. We're shooting at them, and we're missing them by a mile. And we had fighters up there, and they were P-40 fighters. And then suddenly we heard this shoom, and the bombs came very close, and we leaped in on top of two married men. Married men are always more diligent about doing their work.
Oh, gosh.
And and then after that, then we really did dig in.
So the purpose of digging in is to
protect yourself.
To protect
yourself.
You
dig a foxhole.
You dig a hole.
Yeah.
Okay,
you dig a hole
it.
And you get on. Then we built the next day. We got we picked out a space, and we built a shelter. We'd have to take a direct hit. I've been in bombs where the bombs were from here to that door, no farther than that. Five of them went by, and our thing,
20 feet.
Yeah. And the whole thing caved in on us. We had logs over it. We could only be killed by straight bombing. Bombing isn't so bad if you eventually, we had so many of them, like 40 or 45 times. Oh, I kept the diary too, so I know how many times we were bombed and everything. And you're not supposed to keep a diary, but I kept it anyway.
So why aren't you supposed to keep a diary?
I don't know if they think the Japanese might capture it someday and make it information. But I've always done that all my life. Read books and write, yeah.
Right. And just for the people, some of your stories are listed in
Yeah.
In the books, you've got a memoir called Common Warfare.
Yeah, yeah.
And
you can buy it from if you want. But it is, I wanted to make sure there's a difference between assault soldiers and support.
Okay.
I was support, okay?
So that's a safer place to be.
Well, yes, of course, yeah. Because, like, we went on to the, eventually we went to the Palau Islands. That would be a year later. And the 1st Marine Division went into Peleliu. 1st Marine Division, in 6 weeks, they ceased to exist as a fighting unit. The corporals were running companies. That's usually done by a lieutenant or a captain. The assault is really different, okay? Then they send in the 81st Infantry Division. They secured the island. Then my group goes in, and they pull the other ones that are really badly wounded. They pull them out. And we went in, and we do what we called ourselves mop-up troops. That's what we did. We took islands that they didn't want to bother taking. And like in the Marshall Islands, we took 11 islands. But there would only be 15 to 25 Japs on an island, and we would kill them or capture them, or they would kill themselves. And that happened in one case. But you have to make it. I'm making a distinction between assault and support. I was never assault. I was always in this. Well, we were only about 1,300-1,400 people. We can't run up against islands with 20,000 Japanese soldiers with that. That wouldn't last.
Wow.
And so. Those are some stories.
But. No, that's perfect. It sounds like a really hard time. That is challenging. But one of the things that I thought was interesting is not only writing your own stories, but then a couple decades ago, you started to interview some of the people in Centerville and Washington Township had served.
I interviewed 44 veterans of World War II that were in the Army, Navy, Marines, and Air Corps, and Coast Guard.
So why did you choose to do that?
Well, I had been in the war, and I had seen it, and I always liked writing. I always take notes. When I leave this, I'll go home. I'll start working. I'm working on two books right now. And I'm 98, but that's what I do.
That's
okay. It's like
you're driven to do that.
Yeah, I've always liked it.
What was that experience like interviewing those veterans?
Well, I can give you actually in the book, I had the 44. They wouldn't do it. The publisher wouldn't do it because they were in there to make money.
Right.
They would only do 30. So I picked out 30 of the best ones. There was a Marine, for example. Now, I know something about Marines. Both my uncles were World War I Marines, and they're very good. They're all fighters, okay? And let's see, what am I talking about?
About what it was like to interview
the
veterans.
This is the best example I can give. Mm-hmm. There's a Marine outfit that they took the island of Guam. That's in the Marianas Islands. You can look it up on a map someplace. It's the southernmost island. And Marines landed, and they went through, and they went so fast, they bypassed a lot of Japanese positions. And so they said, okay, now you can come back and do it all over again. And that's what they had them doing. And this one Marine, Carl Rotterman, who's from Centerville, he's probably dead now. I'm sure they're all dead. And,
that's why you recorded the stories.
Yeah, right.
So they were preserved.
And he said, I went on a lot of patrols, for example. That's how a lot of warfare takes place as far as I was concerned, patrols, where you have about 12 guys. And I was their aid man. That's like your doctor, okay? I was really pathetic, but I could take care of a lot of things. I still can. Carl said, he said, I was a scout. I said, I was on patrols a lot of times. And he said, I said, what do you do as a scout? He said, the most fearsome thing I ever heard was my sergeant would say, this is a quote, scouts forward and draw fire. What that meant was if you were the scout, you would go forward until the enemy starts shooting at you. Then they will, then, and I said, but won't they kill you or wound you? And he said, oh, of course, that's why you do it. But the sergeant will say, I have to do that because then I'll know where they are and then we'll kill them. So you find out with that one quote that you as an individual are really not important. What is important is the mission, okay? We've got to find where the Japanese are, and they're hiding, of course. And he says, scout forward and draw fire. That's what he meant. You go forward and you do it. And if you don't do it, you couldn't live. You couldn't live. If your sergeant says, you're going on to Bob, you're going on patrol today, say, okay, I'm going. I had very, very little contact with, I don't think I had hardly any contact with officers. I always dealt with my sergeant. My sergeant told me what to do. That's what I'm doing. And you do this to get along because you've got to get along in the Army. I don't know anything about the Navy. We used to tease them when we were on a lot of ships. But I do know something about the Army. And when sergeant tells you to do something, you do it. Or I did, anyway. And I had no problem. That's what a scout does.
Right.
Sort of spooky.
Well, yeah. A lot of younger people, including myself, you know, those stories are, and I'm just grateful that you recorded them.
Yeah.
So that they
that's
are
why I did.
There
yeah.
For,
yeah.
for next generations. And that's what we're trying to do through this podcast is sharing these stories for a next generation. And so let's get back to your story.
Okay.
So you get out of the war, you go back to school.
Yeah, my mother said to me, well, now it's time. She wanted me to leave the house. I think I was always sort of a heartache to them because I pretty much did what I wanted to do as a kid. But I happened to like school, and that was good. And he said, no, you're supposed to get married. Well, I found out that I was only, my girlfriend in high school was only about 16 or 17. Well, you can only, when you're 16 or 17, sitting around, I didn't see anybody for 2.5 years. So she picked up with somebody else. And so I went to Ohio, and that's where I met my wife. And we eventually married, I graduated eventually, worked for a couple of oil companies for about 10 years. And then I went back to school. Yeah. Because that's what I liked.
You were good at school, and you. How did you pick political science as
This is the God's truth. Okay. I thought I would be a history major because I always liked that, and so I said, Janet, you have to go and sign in for me, because at Miami University, that's where I was going for my master's. And so when she came home, I said, What am I taking? She said, you're taking a course in political science. I said, history. And she said, well, they were all filled up. So I said, it's all the same thing anyway. That's how I got into being political science.
It was a mistake, actually.
It was a mistake, yeah. I think a lot of life is mistakes.
But good mistakes.
Good mistakes. Mistake. Like I met her on a mistake. I knew Janet's sister because I dated Janet's sister's roommate back in 1942, and she was already married or something to somebody else. And she said, would you go out on a date with my, I saw her at the grill. I said, went over and asked her to dance. I always liked dancing too. I know girls like to dance too. Or they did in those days anyway.
I still like to dance.
Yeah. Well, I still enjoy it. Yeah. So that's how I met Janet, my wife. Most people meet on a blind date or something, or it's fixed up, and it's an accident, really.
Mm-hmm. Happy accidents.
Yeah, yeah.
So you became a teacher. Now, talk about what brought you to Centerville and Wright State University.
Okay, I was transferred here. I left Sun Oil. I only worked for them for a couple of years. Then I worked with Shell Oil, which I consider a first-rate company. They were really good, and they were very good to me. I have no complaints. But I just found the work boring after a while. You start as a salesman, then you become a merchandiser. And then I was doing real estate, and I thought, well, this is pretty interesting, where you buy properties that you believe will be a future gas station in those days. Now I guess we're going out of the gas business, going into electricity. But even that becomes, to me, wasn't exciting at all. So I went back to school in 1950. I think I started in 53, 54, 55, right in there. Mm-hmm. I went back to Miami University and got a master's degree. Then I was invited to get a PhD at Ohio State, and I did that. And that means when you're going for the PhD, you're going for research. Well, that's what I've always liked. I've always liked reading and writing, and I loved my classes. I would do it for nothing. For me, it was great. And
it's perfect that you found your passion, the thing that you loved. So from what I read, that you were the first political science teacher at Wright State University.
That's right. Yeah.
And you had moved to Centerville at that time.
Yes, because Jenna had a job. She was teaching here in Centerville.
Okay.
So I took this job, and it was offered to me, and I said nobody wanted to come here. Everybody, if you've ever been to Miami, it's a wonderful school. I taught on campus and off campus. I taught Nettie Lee Roth out on Germantown for Miami, and I taught on campus too. And then this job at Rice State opened up, and they had to have somebody, and nobody wanted to come. I said, I'll go, because that's where I was living. I had to drive to Miami every day, or not every day, about 3 days a week. So I came over here, and I started the political science department, and I taught in it for 42 years. And that's where I taught at University of Cincinnati too, but really only for a year or two there. But mostly Miami. Then Miami staffed the liberal arts at Rice State, and Ohio State staffed engineering and mathematics.
To kind of build up the program over the years.
And I went to the first class meeting. The first meeting was in September of 64. There were 54 faculty and two administrators. And that's how it all started. Taught there from 64 until my last class was 2006. 42 years, and I loved every day of it. I'm very fortunate. I've had a very good life, and it's just what I was doing anyway. That's what I'm going to do when I go home from this conversation we're having. I'm working on a book now. Putin just ruined my book. I had it's all done, and then he invades, and my book was about starting a dialogue between. There's no point in talking to Putin. He's going to lie anyway. He's going to cheat. I think he's a tyrant. And we have this very interesting guy called what's his name? The president of Ukraine?
Oh gosh, I wish it begins with a Z.
Zelensky or something like that.
I think it is
It's pretty close. Mm-hmm. And he's a comedian, stand-up comedian actually.
Yeah, he was in a show.
Yeah, and he's calling them Nazis. He's a Jew. His parents, he's not a practicing Jew.
Right.
But he's a very brave guy, and he's out there, and he won't even leave the city of Kiev. They're supposed to take the whole country in 2 days. Well, it's been 4 weeks now, and I think they're holding their own, from what I can see. That's all I have is
the right is on their side, there's a lot of political science. Yeah. Always, it's very interesting to study about those things.
But it ruined my book that I'm working on. It really did. I was all done with it. It was to start a dialogue. I don't think there's much point in talking to them. They're killing. They're targeting civilians. That doesn't do any good. You kill, that means there's just less food. But if you don't kill the fighters, they're going to keep fighting. And I think they're holding their own, at least as of this date they are.
It's a terrifying thing to think about war still happening after, you're almost 98 years. And, that was the World War II should have been the war to end all wars.
Yeah,
and
but
sadly, that's not the case.
Certainly not, no.
Let's come back to Centerville.
Okay. So
what was it like when you moved here in 1960?
Where we bought this house, I won't even hesitate to say the price, but you couldn't even buy a car for what we paid for our house. Now, honest to God, I don't know what it's worth. Every week I get letters, people saying, we'll pay you cash for your Well, I'm not selling my house, of course.
Yeah, it's where your would place you go? To live.
So we moved here, and Janet got a job. We had two boys, and she didn't go to teaching until the youngest one went full time. She was teaching we were living in Kettering at that time. She was teaching at, where was that?
Well, was she a middle school teacher?
Yeah, yes, she was. She was elementary, yeah.
Oh, elementary. Okay.
Elementary. Or,
what did she teach?
She taught everything. She taught 6th, 7th, and 8th. You ended up at Magsie for about 10, 15 years. Mm-hmm. And she taught 6th, 7th, and 8th grade because I would help her set up her room. And I can remember those years very well.
So you were both educators.
Yeah, right. And she, but with public school teaching, it's much more difficult than university teaching. I only had to teach 7 classes a year out at Wright State. And that was considered a heavy load.
So you had, but you had to do a lot more school to
get to PhD.
Yeah,
we have to do,
PhD,
you have to,
yeah.
Writing, you must, they never say that, publish or perish, but that's really the sort of the, that's why you go into PhD, is to do research and writing. Okay. And she taught here, so I was very glad to get it, and it worked great for us. And I...
So you stayed here all those years. What kinds of things did you...
I got into interdisciplinary teaching. One day I was walking down the hall and I saw Nick Piascalzi. He was the chairman of the religion department. He had a picture of Karl Marx on his... I said, that's my area. What are you doing with that picture on there? He told me about this thing called the Marxist Christian dialogue. Well, of course, Marxists and Christians are about as far apart as you can get. Ideologically, and that's what I taught ideology. So we thought we'll have a Marxist-Christian dialogue here in Dayton. We held one at Wright State in 1968, the first one. Yeah. And then it started going, and we did one at American University in Washington, D.C. Then we were invited to go to dialogues, and we did dialogues in the Soviet Union. In Kishinev.
In what decade was that?
That was it was the year of 1978.
Wow, that's so early, yeah. To be going to the Soviet Union.
Yeah, 78. We did one in Salzburg, we did one in Yugoslavia, and we did one in Sweden. Those are the ones I can think of at the moment. Mm-hmm. But those were very helpful to me, really helpful, because what it was is you would have a topic, like, say, alienation. Okay, then I would... All these different professors from all over Russia and our Soviet Union and America, we would meet there. We happened to meet we went to Kishinev. We went to Moscow. I said, can't we stay here overnight? No, no. They have only plan A. They don't have any plan B.
They
very
restricted
tired.
Your travel.
Yeah, we had to fly 1,500 more miles down to Kishinev, Moldova. And we went down there, and that's where we conducted it. So I was in there for about 2-3 weeks in Russia. Then I came back home.
Did your family go with you on
I always took. My wife went on every single trip to Europe. She's never leaving me because she loved all those trips.
She loved to travel
well.
Did you enjoy the travel or just the dialogue was the
No, I like travel. That's a great education to travel. I didn't know that people could take 2 hours for lunch. And like in France, that's what you do. You take about 20 minutes here.
I know, yeah.
And you get a stomach ache.
Or you eat at your desk or something.
Or you eat at your desk. And then, I remember when I think of my wife, I think of her grading at night. Every night till 11 o'clock, she'd be grading something. I don't know. I mean, I graded too, but public school teacher, my neighbor was, that's an easy job. I said, you couldn't do it, friend? Maybe you could do it for a week. I doubt it. But for 30 years, no way.
It takes a toll, for sure.
It really does, mm-hmm. Yeah. Are you a teacher?
I'm not. I did preschool classes for a while. I taught preschool classes.
Okay. And you have 5 kids, but I mean, you can't do anything.
I had my own little preschool, didn't I?
Jeez. No.
I mean, I love children, but it takes a toll on your body to...
Yes, it does.
To do that all the time. So... So you moved here. You chose to live in Centerville. Why did you choose to stay in Centerville?
For the schools.
That's the schools.
I don't have any children, of course, anymore, but I vote for everything because I believe the school system is why the people are here. They come for the school systems. That's why they'll pay an absurd price for my house today because they want to go to, Centerville, Kettering, or Oakwood. That's it. This way I understand my community.
Right.
And I believe.
I know education was important for us when we
were
children.
Well, sure. I mean,
yeah.
Because.
Because you're raising a family.
It determines your, I believe it's associated with your children's future. They hang out with other kids who are going to go to school. You know, you're like your mother used to say, who are you going around with? Who are you hanging around with? My mother would sigh. But I always hung out with academics because that's what I liked. I can't help. You can't really help. Can't really explain things like that. I got interested in reading stories by Zane Grey and Jack London when I was a kid. I thought, wow, what a great adventure.
Those were adventure stories.
Yeah, you know.
Was it the Wild West, Zane Grey?
Yes, it was. Yeah, okay. It really was for me.
I hadn't read that. That's not my genre.
I remember saying, you put down that book, Bobby Payton. That's what my teacher would say that. But so nobody had encouraged me to read or write because that's what I've been doing.
And I wasn't a heavy reader growing up, but when my kids were young, that was my escape, is the reading. And I've always loved to write.
Then.
So we're kindred spirits there. I also love, walking and exercising and things like that. Political science, I think I'm behind the curve on understanding, but my husband loves politics.
Yeah.
And I can get him going talking about that. So let's talk a little bit about, you wanted to share a story about Paul Newman.
Okay.
So why don't you share that story?
Okay. In high school, my senior year,
I knew Paul.
I was in Shaker Heights, so mm-hmm. That's where I was born and raised in Shaker Heights. I went through the whole school system. It was supposed to be a model community or something like that. And I went to Moreland Elementary School and the junior high and the high school. In the high school, in my senior year, Paul Newman, incidentally, was a year behind me in school. I graduated in those days, we graduated midterm, too. I graduated in January of 42. World War II began in December 1st. I graduated 6 weeks later. So I know that I'm going to the Army.
So our part in the war, because
it happened in Europe. Yeah, because
that.
We didn't go in until December 1st,
right.
Or December 7th.
Mm-hmm. After Pearl Harbor.
After Pearl Harbor. And so then I signed up, and I'm going to go to college, of course. And so I did that. And that's where I joined the ROTC, and when the first year ended, they allowed me to finish, or if I would have dropped out, I would be in the Army immediately. Well, I wanted to finish my first year, so I did. And June 1st of 1943, I went in the Army. And I told you a little bit about that.
Right.
I had three campaigns, and
maybe we should mention for people who don't know who Paul Newman is. He was a very famous actor when I was growing up, and who famous for his bright blue eyes.
He was on The Cat in the Hot Tin Roof with Elizabeth Taylor.
Oh, and he was also, my favorite one was Butch Cassidy and the Sundance
Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Mm-hmm. Okay, he was in a lot of things.
And The Entertainer.
The Entertainer?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
So I never missed any. Well, anyway, in high school, and I have, you have the program there.
Okay.
I tried out for a part, and I'm not a good actor at all. I can't get into the part. I'm sort of like a stick of wood. That's how I see myself. I'm not an actor at all. But anyway, Paul Newman in the play, he was a junior, and he didn't even get a part. He was on lights, and you can see it in the program which I brought. Mm-hmm. I think I have, yeah.
Yep, right here.
And if you know the play Hamlet, it's the most difficult play probably for the lead actor that there is. So 1,600 lines. I had quite a few lines. I was Guildenstern. He's sort of like a second-rate spy, or that's what he... Guildenstern, not a very not a man of real character. He wasn't even a decent guy. I think he was sort of a spy of some kind. Anyway, Paul Newman, who I knew, now he was not a, he's not a, like a buddy or anything like that, but I knew him, he knew me. And one time in California, I have the letter, I brought it for Susan, it's here, all the letters between us. He gave an interview to somebody out in California, and he said that, and it was published in the magazine, that he played the part of Guildenstern. So Jack wrote me, Jack was Hamlet. He said, Bob, when he comes to the reunion, you should really nail him, you know, on this. Because I was Guildenstern, and he wasn't, he was on lights. I have other stuff in here, but do you show the picture, Paul?
Yeah, there's a picture of him right here. Oh, it's right here.
Oh, okay, it's okay.
And then there's the...
Anyway, he didn't come to the reunion, and so I wrote him a letter, and I said, Paul, this would be about 10 years later. I didn't do anything for about 7 or 8 years. But then I wrote him a letter, and I said, Paul, I see where you've given this interview, and you said that you were Guildenstern. I said, you must have been riddled with guilt all these years because you know damn well that I was Guildenstern. You were on lights, man, and which isn't exactly saying a great thing. I've often thought the director who picked us, his name was Fry. I'm sure he's dead because he'd be about 110 now or something.
Right, yeah.
Well, that was, it was probably because Jack, my friend, was Hamlet. He said, put Bob in there. It doesn't matter anyway. And I don't know what really went on, how he got the part, but that's the story.
It's so ironic. This great actor didn't even make his high school.
No,
he
didn't.
Play.
No,
he
right.
Was on light.
I met this one woman. She wouldn't believe it. I said, no, I'm telling you the truth, man. Why would I lie about something like that? I don't think lying is very good to do anyway.
But you had the proof that you...
Yeah, I mean, and he wrote me back a nice letter. He said, my head has turned into fizz and bubbles. He liked to drink beer. And that's what he blamed it on, and he was kidding. And I have a signed letter by him there someplace.
Uh-huh.
In that file. That's the Paul Newman story, and... It's fun to tell to your grandchildren that that's all it is, you know.
Yeah, that it is. Oh, here it is. Yeah, Paul Newman right here.
Yeah.
There is the letter from Paul Newman.
Yeah.
So, great story. It's always nice to have a little brush with fame.
Yes.
And especially that you had the part and he...
Yeah, see, I think he honestly, if you're in all, Elizabeth Taylor and all these great films... He got to be acting even when he's quite old.
Yeah.
I remember there's a really good one. It's something about.
And then he has the brand theme with all.
Yeah,
with
all that food. I always buy that, of course.
He has given
over $300 million to charity from his food things. He takes nothing. He doesn't need money. I think his daughters now run it. He had 3 or 4 daughters with Joanne Woodward. And
so a family business.
Yeah, I knew his brother, too. Art Newman was in my class. And I see where I would see his name, too. He'd sneak in on a picture or something, doing producing or designing dresses or whatever he did. I don't know. His brother, Paul was the actor, of course. Mm-hmm. In fact, Paul Newman was very handsome. Art really wasn't.
Hopefully he doesn't listen to this podcast.
Yeah, I don't care if he listens.
No. Okay.
Their father owned Newman Sports in Cleveland. And
That's, yeah, he, pretty athletic family
yeah,
then.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So you've been retired for a couple of decades?
In 2006 is the last class I taught.
So not quite two. Yeah, you had a long, long career.
Yeah.
So what have been your favorite things to do since you've been retired? Because you've stayed very busy still.
The favorite thing, my wife and I would agree, was in 1972, I had a sabbatical leave and I went over to Cambridge University because it's been around for 900 years, and it was a good place to do research. You have a wonderful library there. In the course of the thing, I met a guy called Richard Eden. Richard Eden was he founded a college called Clare Hall. And so in 1980, I had another sabbatical leave, or 80, 81 academic year. Mm-hmm. And I wrote to him, I said, I've been doing this stuff. I got, here's my publications and so on. I think I have 6 books and about 50 articles or something. I said, how can I get affiliated over there? He said, well, how about coming to our college? And so I said, great. And so they gave me an apartment there at Clare Hall in Cambridge for the year. I could only come there for 2 semesters because I had to teach. This would be in 1980, 81. Oh, yeah, I'm teaching still full-time at Rice State. I said, I can't get off that long. So he said, we'll come for the winter and the spring. They call them Michaelmas, Lent, and Easter. They're 10-week terms. Uh-huh. I came for Lent and Easter. Yeah, I was there. And
Michaelmas is like September. Yeah. I think it's close to that time frame.
Yeah, and my neighbor was a guy called Thomas Bresdorf. He was a professor at University of Copenhagen. I just sent him a Christmas card, or no, a birthday card. His birthday is April 1st. Yeah, and I'll be 98, and he will be, I don't know, say 88, something like that. He's retired too, of course. He's a good guy, and we used to talk, and that was probably the greatest year of our married life, because you're meeting all these different students. Well, my college is a graduate college. The only people who could attend my college would be masters and PhDs.
That's
it.
Okay. Cambridge.
I don't mean to make anything out of that. It just happened to be that. Because they have students from all over the world that come to Cambridge. And I had these half a dozen students. I remember this guy from Venezuela, Italy, South Africa, a woman from South Africa, and someplace elsewhere. Sudan, yeah. And you have very intimate relations with them. We would go out to eat, and we would go to parties together. And you talk. That's all you do is you talk. And like at 10:30 in the morning, if you're at the library, they ring a bell. That means it's time to go have your coffee. And then at 12 o'clock, you go back, or 1 o'clock, you go to eat lunch. Then at 4 o'clock, you go to the Senate to have coffee again. Then you have dinner later on. And the interesting thing, you'd be interested in this, particularly lunch. They wanted you to be here at lunch. And you could not sit with your wife. You had to, I would go with Janet there, and then we would split up. They want you to sit any place.
And interact with other people.
Right.
Not your spouse.
That's the whole. And so you end up meeting with guys who are studying volcanoes. I remember that particularly. I don't know why. A volcano and people who study sociology. And, well, that's where DNA is discovered, and I wasn't there at that time. That was in 1953. That's Watson, James Watson. He was at Cambridge too, Crick, C-R-I-C-K.
Okay,
yeah, Crick
that
and
sounds
Watson.
Familiar.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the great thing about that is that you're talking about a lot of different things and interacting with people that maybe know things different than you. It's a great way to collaborate or just expand your understanding about life.
So my big friend was this guy, Thomas Bresdorf. And, in 1848, when Marx wrote the Communist Manifesto, this was probably the most powerful writing ever done on why these... And there were 30 revolutions broke out the next year in Europe and Asia and even in the Ottoman Empire. The only one that succeeded, the one did, Denmark. Denmark overthrew the absolute monarch, and they installed a constitutional monarchy, and they still have a constitutional monarchy. And Thomas Bresdorf is a professor, or he was there. I think he's retired now. I'm pretty sure. But that was a wonderful year for us. I think of it. In '93, by this time I had a lot of publication stuff going, and I was invited to be a visiting professor at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. So I went there, and Jen and I, and this is This is on the mainland, as opposed to Hong Kong is an island, okay? Mm-hmm. So I was on the mainland. That's where the Chinese University of Hong Kong is located. Mm-hmm. And I was a visiting professor for 1 month, the month of January of 93. And I was I only had to give two lectures, one on Marx and one on biology. The one on Marx, they weren't even hardly interested in. What they were interested in is biology and politics. And I had taught a course with my son at Rice State for 12 years. I know enough biology that I'm dangerous, okay? I can write books about it, or I have written. I really shouldn't have, because you read it, it's pretty good. It's about biotechnology and about babies, raising babies and things like that.
That's this one, Issues
American
Political Life, Money, Violence, and biology.
Yeah. And now my partner there, he just died. He's a very young man. He was only 71. You want to take care of yourself, too. He worked very hard, and he just died. Had a stroke, and that was it. And the other one, Donna Schlage, she's retired now, although she's still pretty active. But I can't write a book with him now because
he's
not here. So I'm working on a couple now. I'll work until I drop. I know I will.
And that's probably what keeps you young and vibrant is that you always have something to do every day.
When I go home from this, I'll be working on it.
Mm-hmm. And you have a lot of friends that you get together with, and you seem to stay.
I go to a coffee group. Sometimes they talk about golf, or they talk about. I'm using this. I mean, they're nice guys. They're all nice guys, but I'd rather be talking about something else,
like politics.
Yeah, I would.
Current
I really would.
And
so I try to go once a week. Now I'm going back. I went with Jerry Strange last Friday, about 3 or 4 days ago.
Oh, did you?
Yes, and I'm going to go this Friday again. I usually go once a week. Yeah, I go to that, and we drink coffee and. Just talk. It was just old guys, you know.
Yeah. Everybody needs a connection. I think that what we learned over the last 2 years is that we have to have ways to communicate with people and interact and keep our minds sharp. Those are all very important.
How are we doing on time?
We're doing great. We got about 5 minutes.
Well, no. Oh, really?
Yeah.
My God. Let me see if there's anything else.
Okay.
Yeah. Hey, the thing I would, can I push something?
Anything you
like,
if
you
yes.
If you get a chance to be if you're a teacher, if you can do some interdisciplinary teaching, that has been a wonderful thing for me. For example, I'm quite interested in religion, not in conventional religion now, but there's a woman called Elaine Pagel. She teaches at Princeton, so she's probably not a schuff, okay? She's really bright. She has two books out, one called The Gnostic Gospels and one called Beyond Belief. These two books, if I didn't even know about them when I was in the dialogue thing. She was working on there. It's interdisciplinary. And the work with my son and the biology, if you want to get close to somebody, you work with them on a project, then you are close. That's why marriage is where the people are working together, and you know, in raising children, I suppose. Not that I was a great, I think I was an adequate father, but no more than that, because I mean, I didn't live for them. I mean, I talked to my oldest son probably once or twice a week. My youngest one, he lives in North Carolina, you know, 3 or 4 times a week. I have 2 sons, 8 grandchildren, and 13 great-grandchildren. And even some of them, they're getting pretty good. I got one who's 17. I know he'll go to Madison. He lives in Wisconsin. Uh-huh. He's a good student. So read books, you guys,
Keep your mind going.
And be active.
Well, and I love what you said about working with people. And I actually think, you know, that advice to not make your life revolve around your children is great advice for people today is to have some of your own things that you're involved in. That keeps your mind engaged.
Because, you know, you know, you're born, you live, and a good part of the living is going to involve some suffering, too. It really will. And then you die. But strange thing is, if you create a book or a painting or anything, or maybe you're a great dancer, or maybe you're an architect, or maybe this leader of the whole Ukrainian revolution, he's a stand-up comedian and an actor. I mean, and people are, I see them giving standing ovations. I mean, he's a very brave guy, and he said he's going to stay there and he'll fight and die there. And I mean, so we shouldn't shove these people apart. That's proof, I think. I mean, he's giving the Russians all they can handle. I think it's a stalemate myself right now.
So basically, what I hear you say is, make sure you're leaving something.
Yeah,
leaving the world a better.
Yeah,
better place.
Now you know for women, I've always thought they have a little advantage because because they actually grow this human being in their uterus, and it must be an amazing thing to give birth to a child. Well, you know, a man's role is very limited. But you need to do your best. And
yes, I my children are my greatest.
Well, sure,
creative experience. Yes.
Do you have grandchildren yet?
No.
Oh well, you will sometime.
I hope that happens.
Oh, I'm sure you will.
And if not, you know,
that's okay too.
That's great too. Yeah, that's the ball's in their court.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I have loved visiting with you. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
It was a delight to be with you. To wrap up, I'd like to thank Miami Valley Communication Council for producing this podcast and my guest, Robert Tobobin, for taking the time to be here today. If you have an interesting Centerville story, please contact Centerville Washington History. We want to hear your story. Please also come and visit our museums Tuesday through Friday, 12 o'clock to 4 p.m. We have three locations, 26 North Main Street, 89 West Franklin, and 78 North Main Street. For more information about historical buildings and people, please check our website, centervillewashingtonhistory.org. Thank you. Bye-bye.